Excellent. Okay. So, after this very nice meditation, now's the time to talk something about life, and as usual I try and give a talk about real life rather than theories, and things which have happened. We just mentioned Drew, our president, about the conflict we've had with our local government authority, and how we're solving that conflict. And a couple of people came to ask me today about their community and how one can solve conflict in their community. At the same time, I remember from the last Dhamma Sutta class, which I did last Sunday, there's an old question which was raised, and I wanted to see if I can also bring that in to answer the question of many of you who are out-and-out Buddhists know that there is a conflict between two different streams of Buddhism, the Mahayana and the so-called Hinayana, otherwise known as Theravada, which is us, about, you know, is a person getting enlightened because they don't get reborn again? Is that being selfish? And the Mahayana, they keep coming back again. Isn't that more compassionate? And that's been a conflict which has been going on within for the last 1,500, 2,000 years. So I'm going to see if I can solve both conflicts this evening. All conflicts and that specific one. We used to say in the old days when I was young, that's like killing two birds with one stone. But this is a Buddhist community, so we don't kill birds. So I use new terminology to say this is cutting two carrots with the same knife. So we have to change the usual way of talking about things these days in Buddhism, in this world, and not be so aggressive. And, first of all, about the whole idea of, like, conflict and why we have arguments. And, you know, actually the way that, you know, we try and solve arguments by going to meet someone and talking to them and listening to them and making sure they listen to us. Because, you know, all these types of conflict are just two different ways of looking at things. And there was an old story, and this story, I just adapted it, and it became a joke. And I'm sometimes, I always used to wonder, whenever you read a joke or you hear a joke, they do go round and round, but you sometimes wonder where they started from. And all these jokes, who was the person who invented these? And every time I read some of these jokes, I'm actually quite proud that, yes, actually that's my joke. I invented that. In my life, the one few things which I can claim fame for is actually I've invented a few jokes in my life. And especially it's very interesting when you actually come on the internet and actually you find the joke you invented going round again. Sometimes it changes. This is actually one of those little jokes which I saw on the internet a few weeks ago. And it was started from a very old Buddhist story, which, you know, I used to know when I was a young man. It was the conflict of the two monks who were watching the flag flutter. And one monk said, look at that, the flag is fluttering. And the other one said, no, the wind is moving, not the flag. And they had an argument. This is, I'm going to use this as a metaphor later on. And they couldn't solve the argument. Was the wind moving or the flag moving? So they went to see the Zen monk, and the Zen monk said, you were both wrong. It wasn't the flag moving, it wasn't the wind moving, your minds were moving. And they weren't satisfied with that either. So the three of them, the two monks and the Zen master, went to go and see the Theravada forest Ajahn. And he said, you are all wrong. It wasn't the flag moving. It wasn't the wind moving. It wasn't your minds moving. The problem was, your mouths were moving. And that is an important part. That's actually a little bit of a joke. And I actually saw that in a list of jokes. Not because your mind moves, because your mouth moves. That's where the conflict starts from. That's one of the reasons why if only our politicians would shut up more and not speak so much, we wouldn't have so many wars in this place. And haven't you actually noticed that sometimes it's the mouth which causes much of the conflict in this world? And so, it would be wonderful if we could have one day of silence. We have like Earth Day, and we have all these other days. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have Silent Day, when no one is allowed to speak for one day of the year? Imagine what might happen if we did something like that. Obviously, you know, people like nurses in hospitals and doctors, okay, they may have some exceptions, but most people are not allowed to speak. And they get fined if they do speak. So that will just really make it quite clear that in the West there's no such thing as free speech. It costs. And which is true, there's no such thing as free speech. People think that you should have free speech, and that's part of human rights, but speech is not free. Speech has consequences. Free. Once one realizes how important speech is and how it does have consequences, how it's not free in the sense that it does have an effect, then we can maybe understand that's an important place where conflicts arise. So, one of the great ways of overcoming conflicts in the family, in life, is to shut up. Don't speak so much. But of course I have to, because that's my job. Especially on a Friday night. But it's not just that where conflicts come from. It's if we do speak, one of the reasons is we speak, but we don't listen. Which is where we get conflicts from. We're all too busy speaking and not enough people are listening. And that is one of also the reasons why we're in conflict with planet Earth or with the world. Because too many people speak and they don't listen enough. And by listening, I don't just mean with your ears. I mean with everything you've got, with your heart, with your body, with everything, to listen to the planet. To listen to the person you share your house with everything you've got. And even like you to listen to yourself, to feel yourself, to hear yourself, without talking back. Which is a problem with people. We don't listen. As soon as somebody starts talking, here he goes again. How many times do I have to listen to this? It's the same old record. Why am I having to put up with this? Of course, you're not listening at all. Sometimes it's amazing if you can just really shut up. I don't mean just with the mouth. I mean with here as well. To learn through this practice of meditation how to be still inside between the ears and really listen to what's going on. And it's amazing just how much wisdom you get very, very quickly. And you can also imagine what it's like listening to your body. And the start of this meditation, that's basically what you're doing, being aware, being mindful, listening, feeling this body. I remember the first years over in Thailand, that all our Western monks, is one of my old friends who was a Western monk with Ajahn Chah years ago, you know, we'd always go on arms round, as was our custom even today, without any sandals on, walking barefoot through the forest. And barefoot through the forest, we was always stepping on some root or banging our toes, and we had so many bruises and gashes and band-aids on our feet. It looked like, I don't know what it looked like, but Ajahn Chah saw our feet. I said, what's wrong with you guys? All you Westerners got all these cuts and bruises on your feet. He said, you Westerners have got stupid feet. That's a beautiful way of putting it, because we did have stupid feet. Our awareness was up here somewhere, and the part of our body which was furthest from our head and all this thinking and philosophizing, we were walking on arms round, thinking of dependent origination and the meaning of life, instead of actually looking where we're putting our feet. That's called stupid feet. We weren't really aware, listening, being with what we were supposed to be doing. We're always somewhere else. Like many of you are. How many of you are here? And how many people spend their lives somewhere else? So, when you actually can listen, you're here, you're in this world, you're in this body, you're in this moment, and it's amazing just how much wisdom you get. And I often say that with my own body. Very healthy young I was going to say young monk, very healthy old monk. I really listen to my body. I can actually feel it, see what needs to be done. Relax this part, relax that part, which is why I get very, very healthy. Even just, nice meditation. Before I came in here, my nose was stuffed up with from the wattles just outside, just having allergies. Now that's really clear. It's incredible just how you can take this body and just free it and just get rid of this stuff and that stuff. It's amazing. I told you a couple of weeks ago, and I love this, getting feedback from people overseas, because so many people listen to this talk overseas with that little camera in the back over there. Hi everybody, wherever you are. And this woman wrote to me, emailed back, thank you so much, said I had chronic arthritis, strong painkillers, because of your talks and meditation technique, I've got no arthritis anymore. Totally gone. I like saying that because that gives me just this, the old, if I had any hairs on my head, they'd be standing up. Just, wow, that's really amazing. You can take something like chronic arthritis, incredibly painful. No cure supposedly possible, just heavy painkillers just to get through the day. And this woman, and she's listening now, well done. She's got off her painkillers, and no arthritis, no pain at all. Gone, totally. Which is weird, but I'm so happy that you can do things like that. And I can understand, I can do that to my own body. Great if you can do that to other people's body, just by listening, feeling, being with it. And don't be in conflict with it. I think many sicknesses, illnesses, are because you're in conflict with your body. You're fighting it. Talking, you're not listening to it. Arguing with it. If you understand what I mean. Because when you start to listen to things, instead of speaking to them, when there's no noise going on, then you see so much, and it gives you also so much, as I say, ways of dealing, manipulating, this thing called your body, and getting it healthy. And if it works on your body, imagine how it can work on the people you live with, the conflicts in the office, the conflicts in, especially in the relationships, in the marriage. Listen. When you really listen, you always find out that sometimes, that somebody comes home from work, it's a waste of time talking to them. Even just saying, did you have a nice day, darling? No! I had a terrible day. Get out of here. They're in a bad mood. You have to be really blind not to notice that sometimes, realizing that people actually, if you're really listening, you realize, no, it's not the right time even to say something kind. Give them some space. They need some time by themselves. How you know that, again, is like really listening very deeply. I told this story recently. I think it was actually in the car somewhere. Some years ago, a doctor from, he's one of the doctors who comes here. There's many, many medical caring personnel come to this place. And he came to see me one day. He was just really, really distraught. And his particular problem was, he was an intern, and this is a long time ago, his little pager beat. One of his patients was having a cardiac arrest. He ran as fast as he could into the ward, into the room, next to the bedside, and resuscitated him. But not quick enough. So, there was permanent brain damage in this patient. Maybe 30 seconds later, seconds earlier. And he could have actually got him back to a proper life. But his actions had confined this man into this terrible space, an in-between world of life and death, where his body could survive for many, many more years. But he would never be able to speak, never be able to talk to people or listen to people. He was like in a vegetative state. But otherwise perfectly okay. And he felt so guilty that his actions had confined this man into a state between life and death with no real quality of life, but in that prison of his body for probably many more years. And so he came and asked me, of all people, what should I do next time that happens? I'm a monk. I'm not a doctor. But I know a lot because I know how to listen and feel. This is what I told him. Next time that happens, it will happen again. Get there as soon as you can. Resuscitate. Spend 1 or 2 seconds. That's all. Listen. Feel. Get your mind still. Anyone can do that for a few seconds. Find it difficult. If I just say, and it's really important, just make your mind peaceful. Stop thinking and listen, feel. And what you feel, if you feel, yeah, resuscitate, go for it. If you feel too late, leave it alone. Follow that. And I find that would always be very, very, very helpful for you. It's the listening bit, which ends you with that conflict. Should I do this? Should I do not? Feel it. Listen for it. And it's the same. You can feel people. That's what I do. That's why people keep asking me questions. I don't know why you come here asking all these questions. I've got no qualifications. I haven't got any psychology degrees. I haven't got any marriage counseling degrees. I was never a doctor. I don't know why people keep asking me all these questions. They keep coming here and I get invited to universities to teach this. Why? It's this beautiful learning of how to get to the heart of stuff by really learning how to listen. It's awareness and silence which you can really feel what's going on. And that is a great way where you can avoid a lot of conflict between people. You can actually feel them. You go into a room and feel just how are they, what do they need, you know, what's the right thing to do. And when you can have that degree of mindfulness, it comes across as wisdom. It comes across as compassion for many people because you deal with it in an appropriate way. You actually take a person, please excuse me, but you control them, you mold them, and you get them to actually to say the things you want them to say. It's not that hard to do. Okay, it's a bit sort of nefarious, controlling people, but when you're mindful, you can actually say the right things to get them in the right mood, to see your side as well as you see their side. Find out what they're doing. They have the old saying in the Chinese art of war, know the enemy, know yourself, 1,000 battles fought, 1,000 battles won. Okay, that's a military metaphor which is not that good, but the whole idea of know the other person, know yourself, 1,000 battles won, 1,000 battles fought, 1,000 battles won. What it means is to actually know not just who they are, you know, for all time, but know who they are right now. Know the mood they're in. Know whether it's open for this type of speech or that type of speech. Know yourself, what you're capable of. And sometimes you can't solve a conflict. You have to walk away. Leave it for another time. But when you have that degree of awareness and mindfulness, you can know the right time to actually to get that conflict solved. And a lot of times, you know, conflict, no one likes conflict. It's just really nasty, it's yucky, it's painful, it's a lot of suffering. So you know that people would love to end conflict if they could only find the right way, the right means. And so sometimes to get that right means is to get the groundwork done first of all. And so it's like a bit of trust. How can you actually trust someone if they think they're afraid of you? If they think you're an enemy, if you think they're going to sort of harm you even more, they've already harmed you enough. You've got to actually just to get that trust and that sense of safety before you can actually start fixing that conflict. And the next thing is to actually to get the higher priorities. And sometimes that we have conflict over the most smallest, stupidest of things. And it's not important that we have conflict. It's more important that we can work together and that we can live together. We can have happiness together. It's the different priorities. Okay, here's the old story. I'm looking directly at Dennis, who's our marriage celebrant. This is an old favourite of mine, but I just love saying it. Please indulge me from repeating the old chicken and the duck story. A golden oldie, classic. Because I tell this every wedding ceremony, which I do, I always say the chicken and duck story. And I always remember, just in the car park over there, this, I think it's Malaysian Chinese woman, rushing towards me and saying, thank you, thank you, thank you, that I did the blessing service for her marriage 6 months earlier, and she said, that story literally, she said, honestly, 100%, no exaggeration, that saved our marriage. Because the first 6 months are really crucial, whether you really hit it off together, you can learn how to live together. And this story saved the marriage. And so here comes the story, again, I love saying it, about how to overcome conflict. Young married couple went for a walk in the park one lovely afternoon, and as they were walking in the park, they heard a sound. Quack, quack. Quack, quack. That's not very good, Doug, but you know, that I've been trying my best. Now, I'm a monk, I'm not sort of Richard Attenborough, and I don't really know ducks, but anyway. Quack, quack. You know what I'm talking about. So anyway, as soon as the wife heard quack, quack, she said, oh, darling, can you hear that? That's a chicken. And he said, pardon, what did you say, darling? That's a chicken. And very polite, he said, darling, that can't be a chicken. That's a duck. Chickens don't go quack, quack. That went quack, quack. So that's a duck, okay? And she said, nope, I'm sure that was a chicken. And he said, look, it can't be a chicken. It's a duck. And he went quack, quack again. It's a duck. She said, no, that is a chicken. It can't be. It's a duck. It's a chicken. It's a duck. D-U-C-K, duck. Have you got it? Duck. That's why I like telling this story. I really get into it. And that's that's when she started to cry. It's a chicken. I'm sure it's a chicken. And that's when he looked into her eyes. And this water was welling up in them. And he suddenly realized about conflict. He suddenly realized about what's important. So he looked in his wife's eyes. He smiled, squeezed her hand, and said, darling, no, I think you may be right. I think that may be a chicken. And she looked at him and smiled sweetly, thank you, darling. And they held hands, and overhead, quack, quack, went the chicken. And they walked happily together for a long time. And the meaning of that story is, who cares whether it's a chicken or a duck? Is that really necessary to be right to, you know, and have an argument over chickens and ducks? Number one, he realized what's important in life. Not arguments, but being in love and being in harmony together. And number two, which is also really important. So he had the priority right. Doesn't matter if it's a chicken or not. If she says it's a chicken, it's a chicken. If he says if it's a cow going quack, quack, it's a cow. It doesn't matter. What matters is you're in peace and harmony together. And number two, it's just because it goes quack, quack, does not necessarily, in all situations and circumstances, mean it's a duck. It could be a chicken, as I say, from Fukushima nuclear disaster zone. Mutated. And you know, I've told this story so many times, that of course, it goes on the internet there, and somebody trawls through the internet, and they did send me an article. There was, actually, this is absolutely true, there was an orphan chicken who was brought up by ducks. And it is a chicken. Honestly, it's a chicken which actually does go quack, quack. It proves my point. Just because it goes quack, quack does not mean it's a duck. There is at least one chicken alive in this world today, a real chicken who goes quack, quack. Because it was brought up with other ducks, orphaned and adopted. I love hearing that story. So anyway, she said to me, this woman who we'd done a marriage ceremony for her 6 months before, she said, you know, often with my husband, he said, we'd start having an argument and he would never argue with me. And I thought it was strange at first. And afterwards I got frustrated. You know, I was having some discussion about what colour curtains or what we have for dinner, where we should go for holiday. And he would never argue with me. And one day I got so frustrated with him, I confronted him and said, "Darling, why don't you ever argue? Why don't you actually contribute to our marriage and decision makings? Why are you always so agreeable? It's frustrating." And apparently her husband just said two words. It's actually two words. "Quack, quack." And she suddenly remembered the story. And she said they haven't argued since. That's beautiful. That story actually works. It solved a conflict in marriage. Because look, guys, girls, does it really matter? You know, all the stupid things which we argue over. Isn't there something much more important in this world? All the other things we argue and we fight wars over. Religion, oh, come on. That's... makes no sense at all. Why do we argue with these things and fight over these things? So, you know, taking that story, and many people, if any Mahayanist said, "Oh, it's better to be a Bodhisattva," okay, better to be a Bodhisattva, you don't need to go to enlightenment. If that's good, off you go. Just because they go quack quack, I'm not going to say it's a chicken or a duck. That's what makes you happy, off you go. If you say, no, just... now become enlightened and leave this universe and that's much better, fine, that's fine. But I'm not going to argue with you. We're not going to say one is better than another. And that was one of the first things about the solving conflict. And the other one, which many of you remember, I've got to say it because it's, you know, it's even an older story than the chicken and the duck about, you know, the elephant and the blind men. But, you know, the elephant and the blind man has been done too much time. So, once there were seven blind Australians. And they've never, ever seen a kangaroo before. Even living in this country, but they've heard about a kangaroo and they wonder what a kangaroo actually is. So they decided, you know, the seven blind Australians, to go and find a kangaroo. And feel it and find out what a kangaroo really is. So one of them managed to find a kangaroo and felt the tail. And felt, "Oh, the tail, that's like a snake." And the one who felt the legs said, "Oh, no, elephant is a boomerang." And this is where they bent. The one who felt the pouch said, "Oh, an elephant is a handbag, a lady's handbag." One who felt the joey inside said, "An elephant is a teddy bear." I'm making this up as I go along, by the way. The one who felt if you ever seen the kangaroo's paws, it's a back scratcher. You know, which you use in the bathroom to scratch. The one who felt, where am I going now? One who felt the ears, what's the ears like? The ears like a radar, because they go back from there. Oh, the ears actually move different directions. And the one who felt the head, what could it be, the head? It's like a deer, isn't it? So they all argued what an elephant was. An elephant, because elephant is a boomerang. No, it's not, it's a snake. No, it's a back scratcher. It's a Hermes bag, handbag for women. Now it's got two heads, one at the top, one at the bottom. Or the middle, rather. And they all argued about what a kangaroo was. Now the point of that simile, you know, it's usually just the simile of the blind men and the elephant. The purpose of that simile is to point out that each one of these people were right. You know, the one who felt the tail actually felt the tail. They weren't imagining this. It wasn't some sort of illusion on drugs or something. They actually felt it was real, and to them it did appear like a snake. And the one who felt sort of the pouch, it does feel like a lady's handbag. If you've never actually seen it before, and it's nice and soft, it's beautiful. Every one of those thought they were right, because they had personal experience. And now you can understand why we argue with one another. Because we always really believe that we are right. And we've got reasons for that, our experience. Our knowledge, our research on the internet. I've researched it, it's right. You research something else, other people on the internet, you find something totally different. Now this is a problem. because we always think we're right, just like we think just because it goes quack quack it has to be a duck. We find out later on we are wrong. How many times have you been wrong in life? How many times you really thought you were right and you turned out to be wrong? Each one of us has. I have many times. But at the time I thought I was right. It's only later on. But I learned from it to sometimes say, well, I could be wrong. So what's the point arguing about this? What's the point causing this terrible, terrible conflict between the people I respect and love and care for? So if we do have any conflict, you know, we realize we've missed out the most important thing, peace and harmony, and also, you know, letting go of this idea we have to be right all the time. It's a wonderful thing, even monks next to me know this. In Bodhinyana Monastery, I keep on telling everybody, everyone is allowed to make mistakes in monastery. You don't have to be perfect. And I'm supposed to be in charge of that monastery. Any monk who does something wrong, you guys come and tell me, oh, you have to look after that monk. He's done all these terrible things. He shouldn't have done that. He shouldn't have done this. He's not really a good monk. And I tell them, look, they're learning. They're allowed to make mistakes. Because I know just psychologically, if you're not allowed to make mistakes, you make so many more. You're so tense. When you're allowed to make mistakes, when it's allowed, it's part of life, then actually you're not afraid of them and you don't tend to make so many. How many times at work or in sport or in an exam, you're just so afraid of making mistakes, that fear creates more mistakes. Or just in life, when we're so afraid of messing up in life, then we make more mistakes in life. When you don't care about messing up in life, you don't tend to make mistakes. You tend to flow really quite smoothly in life. So I've noticed that when you let people make mistakes, then they don't make many. So for goodness sake, you've got a partner sitting next to you here or at home, please tell them, darling, you're allowed to make mistakes. It's okay. I don't expect you to be perfect. You can make mistakes. And just, I make mistakes as well. It's life. Say the wrong thing. But the point is, what happens after you make mistakes? What happens is after you've had a conflict, and that's this beautiful part of life called making up. And it's wonderful. It's the end of conflict when, you know, that two people, they've had a big conflict, and in the end, they say, oh, come on, there's something more important than conflict. There's something much more important than being right. That, yeah, I made a mistake, you made a mistake, we all make mistakes. But let's learn from those, grow from those, and become closer, more friendly, by making up. In Buddhism, we call it the forgiveness ceremony. And again, this is something also to overcome conflict in a relationship, in a marriage. Always ask people to do this. Once a year on your anniversary or any important day, sometimes it's done on a New Year day, people come up to each other and say, is there anything which I've done by body, speech or mind? Intentional, I meant it. Sometimes I do nasty, mean, I've done something wrong. Or unintentional, which is more likely. How many times are we unintentionally, by mistake, not really meaning it, said something to another person, they've taken it the wrong way and it's really hurt them? Anything unintentionally by body, speech or mind which I have done or said, or even thought. And also, lastly, anything which I should have done or said which I forgot to say or do. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. And you mean it. It's an incredible thing when you mean that you're sorry. You're saying, I'm not perfect, I make mistakes, I've done some things wrong, so please forgive me. And then the other person does the same. And in the tradition which I came from, if anyone asks forgiveness, you have to give it to them. It was actually in one of the teachings of the Buddha, I think it's in the Devaputta Samyutta, just, you know, to show that I know what I'm talking about. Sometimes I do like to impress people by saying, actually, I know what the scriptures actually say. So, in this particular case, the Buddha said, if someone does sincerely ask forgiveness, to acknowledge that, you know, they're not perfect, they're trying their best, you should always accept that and forgive them. It's a much beautiful thing to have a forgiveness ceremony privately between you and another person and say, I'm sorry, please forgive me. And the other one said, yeah, please forgive me back. They all nearly always do that. Because it's something which touches your heart when someone sincerely asks forgiveness of you. And then, you know, you go and say, ah, yeah, well, it's not just you, it's me as well. I ask forgiveness back. There's this beautiful sense of compassion, love, most importantly, respect. We respect each other. And the last real argument which I had, I'm very proud of this argument, that's why I keep telling people about it, was with the former abbot of Bodhinyana Monastery, because I was always there, but there was another monk who was my boss when I first went over there. And for those of you who see our meditation hall in Bodhinyana Monastery, that was his design. My design was much better, much cheaper. To this day, I still think that. But he wanted his way, I wanted my way. And I wasn't going to give in. No, this was important. This is a monastery. It's really important. The building's going to be there for years. We've got to get it right. And so for a week, we argued. But we didn't. The way we argued is actually, instead of actually looking at each other, we would, just like man and wife, I think, just you said no's to each other. You know, I wrote, no, this is the reasons why we should build a hall this way. And I left it outside his hut. And next, a few hours later, I got another note in front of my house. All his reasons why we should do it his way. It's crazy stuff. That was many years ago. And in the end, you know, hopefully you do come to your senses. The conflict, what are you doing that for? And that's why I came to my court. This is ridiculous. And I'm a monk. I shouldn't be doing this. So actually I went to his hut instead of actually putting a note in front of his door. I knocked on his door, come in, and I said sort of, I'm sorry, I ask forgiveness. And I did the full ceremony, bowing, offering flowers and incense, a Buddhist ceremony of asking forgiveness. And he was very touched by that. And he thought, wow, this is beautiful. This is what monks should be like. And then, you know, there's the making up. And then we didn't kiss. No, we don't do such like that. We just, you know, do the ceremony. So afterwards, and I said to him, I said, once we did the ceremony, he said, oh, that's very beautiful what you said. That's very high-minded of you. And said, oh, thank you. Can I ask for two favors? And that's when he stopped and thought, what's he up to? Is this going to be another argument? And what I said next, I'm always very proud of, you know, I don't mind saying the good things which I've done. I say the bad things, what you do, but the good things are inspiring, and they sort of inspire me. I told him, said, now I've asked forgiveness, sorry for arguing with me. My first favour I want to ask of you, can we build that hall your way? He said yes to that very quickly. And he said, my second favour is, can I be the builder? I want to spend about a year and a half, which I did, building that place your way. And he said, wow, that's really inspiring. And it inspired me as well. It wasn't just, okay, you do it your way. You know, I'm out of here. I'm not going to help you, that stupid hall. So I built that hall. My name's actually on the building license on that hall. And I spent a long time doing that because I thought it's a beautiful thing to do. Because the harmony, the peace, the inspiration was something more important than arguing with people and having conflict. And learning how to work together. Yeah, you can have differences of opinion. You can talk it out and you know, find a sensitive moment by really listening deeply and finding out the right time to talk about these things. And then actually just amazing, the right time and place, you can have these beautiful, beautiful outcomes. Because for me, you know, what is a monastery anyway? A monastery is not the buildings. It's the people. You know, if you go to Bodhinyana Monastery, I'm sure you can find more inspiring buildings in other places. But it's the atmosphere, it's the people, the monks, that's more important. This place over here, Nolamara said, I'm sure you can find a much more comfortable place to spend a Friday evening than just sitting on the floor with your legs aching, squashed in the chairs, difficult to find power parking. There's many more comfortable places to come, but there's something else happening. The atmosphere, the goodness, the kindness, the people. That is what makes a monastery. So I got my priorities right. A marriage. What's a marriage? It's not just the person or the house or something. It's what's between you. That's the most important thing. You get your priorities right in life, and then it's less a thing. It's a chicken, it's a duck. For goodness sake, I'm not going to sort of spoil my day on that stupid stuff. You're higher-minded. Build it your way, build it my way, a hall. It's only a building. It's the people who are in that building. And their goodness, their kindness, their love, their just ability to work together. That is much more important. It's the priorities. And of course, this next part of the story, again, it's one of the classic Ajahn Brahm teachings. It's, why do we have the arguments and the conflicts? Say this almost every other week. The hand. Sometimes being right, your idea, you're so close to your own personal ideas, is like having a hand so close to your eyes, I can't see anything else in the whole world other than my own hand. It's a lack of perspective. If now I can put my hand where it truly belongs, at the end of my arm, my hand hasn't diminished in size. The same size, but now when it's where it belongs, at the end of my arm, I can see my hand and every one of you as well. Your ideas, conflicts, it becomes so close to you, that's all you can see. Your idea, your way of doing things, what's in it for you, whatever it is, your hand, and you put it out where it belongs, you can see so much more in life. It's called perspective. So a lot of times, whenever there's a conflict, it's great just to step away, which means just go out for a walk in the forest, walk by the ocean, whatever, and get that hand away from your eyes and out where it belongs, out here. It's not so big. It's not so important. Now, when it's yours, it gets so close to you, you can't see anything beyond it. Put it at the end of the arm, you can see other things. And it's not just a big deal anymore. So that's why, if you're a theologian of Buddhism, if you're a professor, you can fight to the death over which is the best, Theravada or Mahayana, or Tibetan Buddhism, or Vipassana, or the forest tradition, or Ajahn Brahm's tradition, or Ajahn Sumedho's tradition, or somebody else's tradition, which is the best? And we can fight like dogs sometimes. That's because we don't put our hand out here. This is not important. There's something else which is more important. The kindness, the peace, the compassion, the stillness. That's one of the reasons why, when it gets to conflict, one of the favorite sayings of the Buddha said, the world argues with me, but I never argue with the world. You always wonder that. The Buddha never argued with the world. That's what he said. So can you be a person like that? It doesn't argue with the world. People have so many different ideas, different ways of looking at things. We're never going to say which one is right and judge. We just combine everything. See it from different angles. Respect each other's point of view. And from that respect, we change people's point of view. We listen with respect, and then they listen to us with respect. This beautiful forgiveness happens. And in that forgiveness, in that trust, in that feeling of not being challenged, then we can listen. We can open up and see things in a way we've never seen before. We get the bigger picture of the kangaroo. What is a kangaroo anyway? A kangaroo is this big rock with a snake in the back standing on two boomerangs, with a teddy bear in a handbag in the middle, two back scratchers a little bit further up, and this big head with his two radars, whatever you call it, on. I haven't really got a good simile for the head yet, but you think you know what I'm talking about. And that is a kangaroo. That's a pretty good description. So little by little, if we don't argue, but we listen to each other, combine everything, then maybe we can lessen the conflicts in our world. And imagine if we had less conflicts in this world. What a beautiful world this would be. Less conflicts, you know, in our governments. Less conflicts between religions. It's great when, being a monk here, I sought out people of other religions, made good friends with them. And I missed a good friend just a few years ago, which was the abbot of the Benedictine monastery up in New Norcia, Abbot Placid. He really became a very good friend of mine, so close that when he did pass away, he died about 3 or 4 years ago, and I was really touched that I got my invitation to go to his funeral mass and say a few words. The only non-Catholic in the whole church. And they said no, because we realized you were good friends. And he was a Catholic. I was a Buddhist. We were both monks, abbots. But I didn't let that different in theology actually take away our friendship. Wouldn't it be a wonderful world if we could, I mean, not just meeting people and discussing around tables, but real friends. And realizing there's something much bigger than just seeing what's in front of your hand. Much more important than saying it's a duck or it's a chicken. Isn't there something more important? If you can see that, then you can end conflict. If you can understand that, you won't have so many arguments in your marriage. And divorce lawyers will be out of a job. Thank you for listening. Sadhu. Okay, so we've got some questions over here. From, first of all, the internet was working today. Yoo-hoo. Here we go. Da-da-da. Okay, first question, all from London. Actually, Ben from London, must be Big Ben. You mentioned, terrible joke. You mentioned being peaceful and easy on yourself, but I put off things I need to do outside of meditation, which ends up being stressful. How do I stop procrastinating? Very easy. Put off procrastination till next week. Okay, that's a joke. But no, it is peaceful and easy on yourself. If it really is important to do, then you do it. But a lot of times, things aren't really that important. You don't need to do them. So I think this world should procrastinate more. We do too much, too quick. Don't do today what you can put off until tomorrow, because you might die tonight. So imagine you get everything done. You stay up late tonight, you get all your washing done, you tidy up your house, you get all your emails and letters written, and everything is all done, and you find out tonight you're dead. What a waste of an opportunity. You could have meditated, enjoyed yourself tonight instead of doing all that work. It's going to happen one day. One day it's going to happen. So, well, you put off things I need to do outside of meditation, which couldn't be stressful. If it's stressful, you know, then obviously that you should have done those things. But a lot of times they're not really stressful. You can do it tomorrow. And there's sometimes, there are some difficult problems I don't do it. I put them off. And tomorrow I feel like I find out the situation's changed. I don't need to do it. And so much of the problems you think, this is really difficult. I've got to solve this problem. I've got to write to this person or email that person. And say, oh no, I'll just do it tomorrow. Meditate tonight. And then tomorrow something else has happened. The situation has changed. And I never needed to do it anyway. Has ever that happened to you? So sometimes procrastination is actually just the best option. It means you don't have to do anything. Problem solves itself. But if there is something you need to do, then you better do it now. If it's going to cause you more pain, then do it. If it's going to cause less pain, don't do it. How do I live with annoying and noisy people in my house? If it is your house, evict them. Your house. If they're noisy people, earplugs. I got earplugs, which I got them when I go on an aircraft. I don't know, every aircraft you got, they've always got these kids who end up screaming and hollering. And sometimes you're in sort of the cabin, There's about three kids. You know it's going to happen. As soon as one starts, the other three start. And oh, it really drives you crazy. I always thought that, you know, an aircraft, if any sort of aircraft managers or something, can't you have like a little room in the back for the kids? You know, just padded, so they can go for their lives and you can actually be in the front and be nice and quiet and meditating. But no, you can't do that. Anyway, so how do you live with noisy people in the house if earplugs won't work and annoying? Then you use a great teaching of my master's. It's not the noise of the children disturbs you. You disturb the noise of the children. That's what children do. Children make noise. Husbands, you know, keep on saying, I'll do it tomorrow, darling. Wives, nag, 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 nag. Dogs, woof, 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 woof. That's the nature of this world. People make noise. And this person from Malaysia, I probably got somebody else over here, that's actually not tonight. They probably, from your house, they probably ask the same question. How do I live with annoying and noisy people? Because you're probably annoying and noisy as well as the other people are. We always think it's somebody else's problem, don't we? They're noisy. We never think I'm noisy. We always say, this happens, you know, when on my retreats, which I do over in China Grove, there's a room, there's a cottage with six people. And someone says, can you please tell people not to snore in the cottages? And then the other people also say, can you tell people not to snore? We never think we snore. It's other people snoring, but we snore as well. So, live with annoying and noisy people. Welcome to the world. People are annoying. And they are noisy. And you're one of them. And I'm one of them as well. I'm sure I'm very annoying, telling the same old jokes every week. And very noisy. So how you do... tolerance. Soften yourself and don't disturb the noise. If there's something you can do, do it. If there's nothing you can do, just make peace with it. And it's amazing just how you can make peace even in noisy environments. And other times you see people annoying. Why is it that I'm really so impressed with mothers of young children? Young children can be so annoying. But mothers that love them, they can actually tolerate it. So why can't you tolerate annoying people? Because a mother has this beautiful love for a kid and understands they're going to poo in their pants, they're going to get up in the middle of the night to feed them, they're going to get sick, and you're going to just really give so much of your time. You're going to get really tired because of that kid. But you don't really look upon them as being annoying or noisy because your love is much greater than that. You change your priorities. Also, anyway, from Ireland. What is the best way to resolve conflict amongst friends? If it's from Ireland, take him to the pub and buy him a drink. That's because we're Buddhists. They don't do that in Ireland. Resolve conflict among friends. Be the first one to go around and see them. One of the other proud moments of my life, I was going to Queensland. I went to this person's house for the lunch, this Sri Lankan man, and his younger son was there, and I said, where's your elder son? And the younger son said, he won't come. I said, why not? He said, because they had an argument. The elder son, this elder brother, this young guy, had an argument with his father 7 years ago, and they hadn't spoken to each other for 7 years, and they hadn't even seen each other for 7 years. Because of conflict. And because, you know, I'm a senior monk, and some people are actually afraid of me, they think I've got powers, I can do all sorts of stuff. So, you know, I decided to make use of that myth, and just told the younger brother of this guy, I said, have you got his phone number? I said, yes, give him a call, now. And so he called his elder brother, who hadn't seen his father for 7 years. And I sort of took the call and said, this is Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm, really? The real Ajahn Brahm? I said, yes, I command you to come to your father's house now. And I ended the call, no argument. Now, you know, for some people, you know, some of the Sri Lankans here can maybe understand that there's so respect a monk like me. This poor guy didn't have any choice at all. So he came to his father's house. So they're in the same room for the first time in 7 years. They wouldn't look at each other, just looking opposite directions. And so asked the father, first of all, what happened? I love this story because it's absolutely true. What happened? And he said, I can't remember. It's crazy, human beings. Then I asked the son, said, no, what did your father do? And he said, I can't remember either. I said, okay, 7 years is enough. So turn around, look at each other, and say sorry. And they did. And it's just a beautiful thing to get father and son 7 years of being apart to end that conflict. And it was stupid. It was a small thing, a chicken or a duck or something like that. And then, for some reason, they were just so proud that they would not sort of actually give in. They needed me to actually be the circuit breaker. Sometimes that's all you need. And they came together again. And now he was at a monastery recently. He did some electrical work and offered all sorts. What did he offer? A monastery thing. He offered a really expensive stuff. I forget. Oh, he offered those tables. That was him, yeah. Yeah, no, he offered the stainless steel tables. It must have got about $5,000 or $6,000. To our monastery. Just an amazing person, because got his family back together again. Ended the conflict. And he asked, why? I don't remember. Conflict is crazy. So sometimes to get people together, the best way to resolve conflict among friends is actually, if they're Buddhists, tell them that Ajahn Brahm will put a curse on you if you don't come together. I can't do curses. If I could, I wouldn't. But anyway, just make the first move. Just go and see them. It doesn't matter just who did what and when and how. It's much better. And this is amazing. If a person makes the first move, like I did to Ajahn Chakra, just go to his heart and say, I'm sorry. And people really respect that. Because we want to be friends. We don't go there to tell them what they did wrong. Just say, okay, forget about it. Can we please be friends again? Otherwise, don't die as enemies. Die as friends. Any questions from the audience here, before we finish off? Okay, just quick, yeah. I should be asking more quickly. Yeah, go on. Somebody broke something's trust. It's a very serious conflict. Remember, allow people to make mistakes. They do break your trust. Forgive them. It's amazing when people do that. And somebody once asked me, how many times should you forgive? My answer was, always one more time. This is powerful stuff, because we go to a much higher level. You know, we're just actually trusting another person. And in my experience, most times they live up to that trust, if you really give it. If it's in a relationship, you can do something which I call probation. They've broken your trust, okay, probation 6 months. You do that again, you're out of here. But I give you 6 months to prove yourself, to get that trust back. But give people a chance. If you give people a chance, a very clear chance, like probation, a lot of times they take that opportunity and they'll never let you down again, because they know you've done something very amazing and wonderful. You've forgiven them. Wouldn't you like that to be given to you when you've made a mistake and you've broken somebody's trust? They give you a chance. You live up to it, most times. Okay. Okay, so let's pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and then we can actually do what we need to do.
Arahaṃ sammasambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavatā dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi suppatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sango Sangang Namami.